This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast at voiceofvashon.org, and on Comcast Channel 21. During the next hour, I'll be talking with author Annette Janelle about her book, My Year of Beds, chronicling her adventures as she drove solo around the entire globe. Annette, thank you very much for being on the show, especially so last minute.
It's my absolute pleasure, March.
So I am feeling super lucky right now and very grateful to my friend for inviting me to attend the Vashon Rotary meeting this morning, where you presented about your current book, My Year of Beds, and the realizations and insights that you gained during your travels, and also plans for your next book, which I believe has a working title of Searching for Galileo. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes, indeed.
So how about we go ahead, since you are not from the island, how about we start off with a little background for our island and global listeners? If I understand correctly, you spent most of your life and developed your previous careers in South Africa.
Yes, indeed. I immigrated with my parents from Germany when I was quite young. And so I went to school and grew up in the Johannesburg region of South Africa. And then as an adult, moved down to Cape Town, where I was a photographer, and then progressed to becoming a painter and doing murals and trompe l'oeil and such like before setting off on my global adventures.
Right. Yeah. Now, that means that you did live during very interesting times in South Africa as well.
Indeed, I did. I arrived in South Africa when apartheid was absolutely fully integrated in the society. These are things that I mention in the book and how they absolutely influenced me. One might not believe one is a certain way, but social influence is very strong. And right. So I discover as I travel that, yes, racism is something that can be ingrained in you even though you don't want it to be. And then, of course, I lived through the revolution.
Right.
And I lived through the first general election to launch what we then called optimistically the Rainbow Nation. Yes, it was interesting times.
Yeah. Are you ever planning to possibly write just specifically about that, or do you feel that enough has already been, it's already been covered?
I confess that when one is an immigrant, one has to be both. It takes a long time to integrate into a society. And I do mention this partially in my Year of Beds, in which I introduce myself and where I'm coming from so people understand my worldview. Mm-hmm. People are quite quick to say that, oh, these people should integrate. But it doesn't happen terribly quickly. My parents were, of course, adults. Culturally, they were German and are still German. And I grew up in essentially what was a German household. And then I went to various different kinds of schools. I went to an English school, an Afrikaans school, and in South Africa, we were not just separated from a racial point of view, but also a language point of view. So there was much racial separation. And I never really felt I fitted in to South Africa as a culture. So I don't really have anything specifically to say about the country other than how this sort of separation, intolerance towards one another never really comes to any good conclusion. I just don't have much else to say.
Right. Well, and that's fairly succinct. And, yeah. Now, so it just occurred to me, I believe, now you went around the world in a car by yourself, and those shipping containers for getting across the oceans, correct? Okay. But you did not, or did, go through Africa partially?
No, I didn't. I flew from South Africa to Germany, where I am a citizen as well. And there I have many friends and family, and I bought a car there. And the intention at first was only to travel as far as China, to go as far as Shanghai. But that was such a business trying to get the car into Shanghai. I thought, well, I've gotten this far. What now? Am I going to turn back and ship the car back to Germany? It seemed a bit tail between the legs.
Right.
So I changed my mind, and I said, well, I'm just going to drive once around the planet. So I shipped the car instead to America.
That's fabulous.
And then spent 3 months traveling across the length and breadth of America before shipping it once again to England. And then it became a global trip. Yep.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it was actually an accident. It wasn't an intentional, at the beginning, global trip.
No, it wasn't.
It
was a possibility, but I wasn't saying it out loud at the time.
Right.
It seemed a bit sort of extreme. Driving to China was a bit extreme.
You were going easy on the family and friends who were already freaking out a bit, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see here then. One of the questions or ideas that I discuss with almost all of my authors has to do with the idea of the inciting incident. From a writer's perspective, you're going to know this, but I always mention it for my listeners, is that the inciting incident is that event or experience in a character's life or story that stimulates all that comes next. For example, for the young people who maybe love The Hunger Games, which is a very popular movie series right now, you know, the inciting incident would be when Prem is actually chosen to go to The Hunger Games and Katniss stands up and says, "I volunteer."
Yes.
Prior to that, you know, hunting or playing with the cat or, you know, whatever was going on, though, but that one moment incites everything else that follows.
Yes. And it launches you on your quest.
Exactly. There you go. I love working with authors. So given that you managed to transition from a generally mainstream, comfortable, or sort of normal lifestyle to a solo, global driveabout with a handful of Sharpies in your, you know, for people to use, that occasionally found you digging your way out of a sandy road with the use of a yoga mat in the middle of Uzbekistan, what, I dare ask, might have been your inciting incident?
Ah, you see, but we as authors always make these inciting incidents very simple, sort of an epiphany moment.
Right.
And because of what I'm doing right now, I don't want to go down that road because life is not ever that simple.
Right.
It's very few of us that get to see the burning bush.
Right.
Most of us stumble along and hope for the best. And there were several incidents, I think, in my life that came together. It was a situation of my parents' health that prevented them from going on their own global journey that they'd always wanted to do. It was a situation of a friend, a very long time school friend, who went off on a journey. She was one of these people who always said yes. She was so afraid she might miss something. And so they went off on a canyoning weekend, which involves rappelling down waterfalls and then going off onto rubber rafts to the next waterfall and then rappelling down. And they went off for this adventurous weekend. And a flash flood snuffed out their lives just like that.
Yeah.
So that was that moment. And then at the same time, we learned that my aunt here in America has cancer. And so these things all came together and made me realize that, you know, what's the point of saving up for tomorrow for a good old age and the whole thing? I'm just going to go and live my life. So I went off to see China.
And then drive through China. I mean, not like fly in
out
in a hotel be safe, but to literally drive the roads of this huge country.
Well, yes, I am a bit of a nomadic road tripper anyway. And I thought, there's so much more interesting road tripping. I've got my independence. I can stop where I want to stop. And so, yes, off I went. Some people have these incredibly long-term goals. And I come from the point of view, I said, but I don't know what's over the next mountain. How can I have a long-term goal? I don't even know if the mountain I'm climbing or the peak I'm climbing towards is up this mountain that I'm climbing. I might get to the top and see that that peak is on a completely different mountain. So I'm not really big on long-term goals. I'm big on philosophical goals, but not actual goals. So this tour, this journey really was, it was an evolution.
Right.
Yeah. It was an evolution.
What's beautiful about it, so the other month, previous month, I have interviewed Julian Hoffman, a lovely author. And he has a similar, you know, situation where they didn't have some long-term goal that one day they were going to make it to the northern reaches of Greece.
Yes,
you know, it just happened.
Yes.
They knew they wanted to go somewhere.
Yes.
They were ready for life to happen.
They were open to it.
And then it came and they recognized that's it. But if they hadn't been already looking, probably it would have just passed them by. So, but what's beautiful about it is that they're normal. You're normal.
Yes.
I'm normal.
Yes.
You don't have to be some extraordinary, rare, special human to do this. You can be anybody.
Well, this is why what I say to people when they, you know, one becomes this inspiration. I've become by default this inspirational speaker. This was also never my intention to stand on a stage and tell people how to live their lives, which I still don't do because I think that's just, it doesn't work like that. But what I do bring to the stage is the fact that I am so normal and I didn't have any dreadful thing happen to me. I didn't survive cancer. A shock didn't attack me. Nothing. I just made a decision. I'm going to go and do this. And if I should be completely banal about this, this exciting moment might have been, I had to have my house valued at the time. The municipality said for tax reasons, I had to have my house valued. And they came and they valued my house. And I had done various renovations because of my previous occupation, which was interior painting and decorating and so on.
Right.
I had turned this house into quite a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they valued my house, and I said, my house is worth how much? So I don't need a house that's worth that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I suddenly realized, through no particular purpose or reason, I had actually suddenly created this pile of money in my house, which I released.
Right.
Became debt-free instantly, which was amazing.
Oh.
Everybody should strive to be debt-free.
Oh,
it
yeah.
is such a sense of I can do anything.
Oh, that's nice.
And then I said, well, now I can just go off and do this amazing road trip. So that was one of the things I just suddenly, just through being creative, trying to create this wonderful environment for myself and my child, I had also created this monetary wealth, which I had no intention of doing, but there it mm-hmm. suddenly was. And I said, yes, I can do that. Pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Right. Let's put it to some good use.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
and it launched me onto a completely different path.
Right.
Mm.
Because you were open.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Adventure.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, okay. So let's see here then. If you caught us partway through and you are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on Voice of Vashon, my name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking with author, global traveler, and out-of-the-box thinker, Annette Janelle. Janelle? Or Janelle? It's German. How do you really say it?
You really say it Janel.
Janel.
Janel, yes.
Okay. Annette Janel and I are hanging out. Okay. And she is the author of My Year of Beds. And right now, I'm looking at my notes here that I scribbled in the margins and the empty spaces of a Point Defiance Zoo pamphlet, which was literally the only piece of paper in my backpack when I went to the Rotary meeting this morning and you started your presentation. And within about 38 seconds, I'm scrambling through my backpack and going, oh my God, I don't have my notebook. Where's my notebook? And I'm like, okay, I have a zoo pamphlet and I have a pen. I have
power. I will make do.
I will. I know. So
that is the best way to live a life.
Yeah.
Take what you got and make the most of it.
So here are the things that I jotted down, which will immediately tell my listeners why it was that I then said, can I interview you right now this morning before you leave? So the media curtain.
Yes.
I love the visualization
yes.
of that. Tolerance, which I believe was the first word written on your van.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about your beautiful van. Loss of media blizzard, which is how you described the experience of heading into countries where you didn't know the language and just the media blizzard that surrounds us was just suddenly gone.
Mm-hmm.
Borders as a way of creating fear and mistrust between people, sort of arbitrary and negative impact of borders. A global splash of goodwill, which I think describes the end result of the van.
Yes.
A man in China, I believe, wrote, a clean world and clean air for everyone.
Yes.
And I believe that a man on the Russian border wrote, may all men be human.
Mm.
Okay. Now, what's interesting, we'll mention a little bit about, I believe it was only men.
Yes.
Over the age of 35.
Yes.
Were invited to write on your van. And you, why don't you explain to the listeners why you chose to make that demographic?
Yes. Well, the project was called One Planet, One People. Mm-hmm. And in this, I asked men above the age of 35 to write a whoosh for the world on the car. And the reason I chose this, well, the first was a pragmatic reason. As an artist, one doesn't, when one is using whatever medium it is, whether it's paint or crayons or whatever, you don't use every single color that you've got and shove it all on the one painting. You want to create a certain effect, a certain mood, so you choose certain colors. And in this case, I was choosing the minds of a certain demographic, men above the age of 35, men who, despite what women have achieved over these past decades, are still in the powerhouse, in the driving seat of the planet. So driving seat, men, cars, okay, am I going to do? So I created what I call participation pieces. This is one of a series of participation pieces that I've done in which I set the perimeters and I get other people to do the creative parts.
Right.
And I wanted to know what men, because I knew it was going to be an ongoing journey, I wanted to know what this particular group of people would say to essentially a fluffy girl question, a wish for the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's why men. And as I said in the talk, I discovered through my extensive research that men all around the world at heart are beauty queens. They all want world peace.
They really do, don't they?
They really do, and love and tolerance and respect. Mm-hmm. So this next book I'm working on, Searching for Galileo, is working out what it is in our minds that stops us from doing this, from becoming this. So, yeah.
So you set off in this lovely van with your handful of Sharpies. And I would imagine, too, actually, that choosing men over the age of 35 was safer in some ways, because in some countries, I think that women in general, or young women in particular, if you were to approach them and ask them to write something, either they are illiterate because they have not been educated on purpose, or perhaps family would be upset that you were talking to a female member or something, even if you're a woman yourself.
What did you notice about the
difference between male and female as you traveled the globe?
Yes, I know. I must admit I wasn't that clever when I thought about all of this. Yeah. But yes, certainly it was. By the time I got to San Francisco, this was really heading towards the last quarter of my journey, I met up with a poetry man whom I mention in the book, and he stepped up to me. It was at Big Sur, a foggy morning, and he stepped up to me and he said, "You know, your van has got such an aura about it." And at that point, I wasn't talking about auras. I was not going there. I was pragmatic, practical, German person.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But he was talking about auras and how this car just had something. And he went on to write something on the car. And afterwards, I thought about that. And I thought, well, maybe he was right. You know, this whole business of men having written all these really good things on the car, love, tolerance, respect, no war, no hunger, peace, etc., in all the languages and all the scripts of the world, possibly did create this aura of goodwill that was a little protective bubble where men who approached the vehicle, as I said, they started to become influenced by the writings on the car and that they really did step up to the plate and didn't want to then let the team down by being the bad guy in the crowd. So who knows, maybe it was safer. I do believe that it was safer then from that point of view, that it was men, the peer group, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. They're like, oh, I can relate to those people because they're my people in a way.
Yes.
And also there's safety in the anonymity, I think, and the fact that the van wasn't going to stick around.
No.
So what you couldn't say in front of the local chieftain, or what you couldn't say in front of, you know, the guys, you know, you could write something maybe when people weren't watching, or it would drive away, you know.
That's right.
And you could be perhaps a little bit more honest and a little bit softer than when
men
are having to put on their show.
The guy conversation.
Yeah.
There's a part in Uzbekistan where I go to a car wash.
Oh, my.
I am German, you know, the German housewife. I have this talk that I give to ladies where I sort of discuss all my little inner characters, the Indiana Jane and the Miss Priss and the German Hausfrau and all of these things. So the car got washed regularly. And if one is going to be living in one's vehicle, one wants to keep it neat and tidy. So at this car wash in Uzbekistan, all these men were, I could just sense, say, oh, take me with you. I mean, I want to come too. And I recognized that I was the sort of female embodiment of the knight in shining armor, or knightess in shining silver van.
Right, right.
And yes, I think men have put themselves into a box through wanting to control everything, rule everything, that they've had to pretend that they're much harder than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
I think most men at heart are actually terribly sensual, very soft, very loving. It's just
and they're
that
not
this,
allowed to be.
Yes, and it's just this thing that they've made for themselves, this box that they've made for themselves. And yeah, maybe breaking through that little barrier would be a terribly useful thing. We need to liberate men, not women.
That's such an excellent point.
We need to there needs to be a men's lib organization movement to liberate them from this coat of armor that they've dressed themselves in.
Or been dressed in. There's the movie Brokeback Mountain, is what it's called. And there's a scene in there where one of the young men who's played by the actor who died, but there's a scene where when he was just like in Montana or,
I've seen it.
And he's taken by his father to go see what was done to a gay man. And they basically, the people in the town, the men had beaten and castrated and murdered this gay man. And then they take their little eight-year-old child along with them to go see that. And that's their way of saying, you better not be gay or someone's going to do this to you. And that's what they seem to think that their small child needed to learn.
So when we look at what happens to men. That scene out of my mind.
Yeah, it's short, it's small, but it really stuck with me.
Oh, I think I probably just went, I'm not remembering that.
Right. But think of the epigenetics element of that.
Yes, of course,
The absolute fear. And then those two young men were never able to overcome in their life the fear. And that's what really ruined. I mean, if they could have just left their life and gone to San Francisco together, they would have been really happy.
Yes, of course.
You know. So when we look back, you do mention multiple times there's the element of waking us up to what I like to talk about as the bell curve.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's this basic concept we learn in university about the bell curve and people go, oh, yeah, it's probably basically true. Mm. And then they just drop it. If they're not talking statistics or some math concept, they just drop it. But the reality of the bell curve is that on almost every subject you ever talk about with human beings, there will be the few people like the 2% that are extreme on one end and the 2% that are extreme on the other end. And those two get all the media coverage.
Yes.
Like, oh, global warming is going to destroy us. There's no global warming at all. Yeah. Well, okay. In the middle, you have this huge mass of people who are deeply underrepresented in the media, but who go out and buy the magazines and the newspapers that flaunt the opinions of the 2% on either side. And then those people in the middle think to themselves, oh, well, in my head, I'm the only person who thinks this way because obviously everyone's thinking the way I see in the newspaper. And so we have this absolute, and you wrote it, you said there's the media curtain, but you also said you watched them during the global crash of 2008, 2009, and you watched how the media used that to manipulate the people. And I just was wondering if there was something you wanted to say a little bit more around the ideas of media and its use and its impact on society.
I get to a point in my book when I arrive in Bosnia-Herzegovina in Sarajevo. And I book into a hostel via the internet, which is not always a good idea. And when the hostel owner says, well, I'll pick you up at this point and I'll take you to the hostel, then you know you've chosen a really bad one. Anyway, so I finally get to this hostel and the man asks for my passport. And he sees that I'm from South Africa. And he immediately makes the statement. He says, oh, that must be a terrible place to live. Then he thinks about this for a minute and he says, actually, maybe living in South Africa is not so bad, but living amongst blacks must be really bad. And I'm like, what?
Where is this coming from?
You've just met me. How can you presume that I even vaguely agree with you just because we have a similar skin color? So I asked him, I said, you know, have you been to Africa? I mean, where does this come from? He says, no, he saw this on the local news, TV news. So he made a snap decision about the entire continent of Africa based on some weird news program that he saw in Sarajevo.
Right.
And we do this. That's a complete thought control thing. And this is, of course, what my next book is about, to try and break out of this. In my searching for Galileo, what I'm trying to do is I'm going from the premise that we really are in a position from a technological and curiosity and awareness point of view where it's merging, that we are at a point now in our development of being able to fundamentally change the way we think. Mm-hmm. And when we each start changing the way we think, these things that we hope for will come true. But we need to work on our own thinking in order to make them come true. They're not just going to happen.
Right. And so how about we switch over a little bit of the working title again is Searching for Galileo.
Yeah.
And you had made some comments about, during your presentation, about the impact that Galileo had on shifting the paradigm of how, I'm not so sure it's the world. I think it was more the European world.
Well, it was the known world at the time.
The known world at the time. Yeah. Did he have impacts that went into Asia and the Middle East as well?
Well, I don't quite know that. I use this as a evocative example because, of course, it wasn't Galileo who had the first thought about the earth moving around the sun.
But
it was
Copernicus. A new star, right?
Yes, that really did happen. That some 400 years, a little longer than 400 years ago, that really did happen. And Galileo did see the star, And it did get him thinking again.
Where'd it come from?
Yes. Yeah. If it's all static, where did the star come from?
Right.
But Copernicus, of course, had theorized this before, but he didn't have the technology.
Mm-hmm.
But in Galileo's age, they developed glass lens cutting to the point where they could, in fact, make telescopes.
Right.
He was not the only one who made this, but he's just the one who history
yeah, who
caught
we
him
remember
up,
mostly.
Who we remember
right.
up.
Right.
So, you know, all of this was happening, as everything always does. These moments in history, they happen everywhere.
Was that at the same time as Calvin? The breakaway from the Catholic Church and the writing of the Bible in the
Sorry,
common languages? I think it was, though.
I'm not that clever. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I don't know exactly either, but you're yeah. right. It like they say, the Renaissance, it was just yeah. like there was this explosion then, as
yes.
there is right now with
yes.
the information age.
Yes.
And what's going to come?
Yes. And, of course, a similar explosion happened at the turn of the century in the 1900s. Between 1889 and 1900-whatever it was, there was a huge change in thinking.
Right.
With Freud and Jung and all these people who got involved in it was a thinking collaboration where artists and scientists and
mm-hmm.
philosophers, they all got together and they started creating these new thought patterns. There's a fantastic book one should read called A Terrible Beauty by
Ooh.
Peter Watson, a huge, great big chunk of a book, which chronicles those 100 years from 1900 to 2000 and how the thought process of humans
right.
have shaped and pushed us to where we are today.
Right.
So this is probably just an ongoing thing. But yes,
mm-hmm.
but what my premise is in this new book, In Searching for Galileo, is that
right.
we have now the technology that allows us to go right down to a molecular, submolecular level into our brains, into our bodies, and we're starting to discover things about ourselves that we never knew.
Right.
Or maybe we had an inkling of in the various philosophies, maybe the Asian, Eastern philosophies, but we could never prove it. And of course,
right.
our thinking has gotten to a point where we want facts.
Right.
We want proof. We want to know.
Right. It's got to be, you know, you have to recreate it in
yes.
a lab.
It's sort of thing. And
you know,
they're getting
yeah.
to a point now with our technology where they can.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book is about finding these new Galileos who are putting their technology together with their curiosity and their theories and saying, holy mackerel.
Right.
Not only is what we thought true, but there's more.
Right.
So this whole...
So we have our own Galileo, like the gentleman you're going to meet with in Seattle right now.
Well,
we right now are in the world today, there are the, quote, Galileos of the
oh,
future.
Yeah.
400
oh,
years from now,
yes.
they're going to look back and they're going to talk about the people
that's right.
that are not showing up in mainstream media.
Yes.
Just like most people didn't know about Galileo when
yeah.
he was alive.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
but we know about him now.
Yes. Because we can look back. 2020 hindsight is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
So people often ask me at these talks, they say, so when do you know you'll find him? And I'm going, well, first of all, I don't know if it'll be a him.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I probably won't know because mm-hmm. history will tell.
Right.
But the idea is to make people understand that possibly and probably we all have that element of Galileo in us, this curiosity, this ability to change. And yes, they are absolutely in science, neuroscience, showing us just how plastic our brains are
right.
and how changeable they are and how we can consciously make decisions to change how
right.
we think.
Or we can decide mm. to not change.
Yes. And of course, it is when you start making those choices, personal choices, deep brain choices. It's like choosing to go to a gym and developing your biceps and your
right.
abs and whatnot. We all know how difficult that is. And changing
mm-hmm.
the brain is a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But the advantage of changing the brain is once you start consciously making that effort, you can make all those changes that you want in your life, you can make them happen by thinking them into
mm-hmm.
reality. Going to the gym becomes easier because you know your brain likes it. It enhances
mm-hmm.
your health. It enhances your brain function. Stopping smoking becomes a no-brainer. Stopping drinking
mm-hmm.
becomes a no-brainer because you know that all of these things are counterproductive to your mental function. And so you think those dreams that you have,
mm-hmm.
you start to recognize it's not your dreams that come true, but your thoughts come true. And
mm-hmm.
as you become more and more mindful of how you think, you start recognizing why you're not getting to your goals. It's because your thoughts are undermining you, and often it's your subconscious thoughts that are undermining
mm-hmm.
you. And when you become mindful of this, you can start putting those aside and saying, you are not beneficial.
Right.
And you can start focusing on the thoughts that are beneficial, and you can change your life in any way you like. And
right.
I am proof of that. I am.
You and many
others,
people who we, oh boy, we have the wrong people getting the limelight in the
thing.
Media.
Yes.
We need to refocus our attention.
Because people like me don't sell anything. Right. We don't flog anything. I am not a blank billboard for somebody else's produce.
Right.
Yeah, or products. Yeah. I don't sell anything. Really, my thing is I want everybody to become mindful. Mm-hmm. Because then we will all start becoming more honorable. We will all start becoming more self-controlled. And in doing that, we will all start building this amazing future in which these Galileos can blossom and come up with these incredible things, in which this freedom that we think we have will become a reality, in which this harmony that we want will become a reality. But we have to change, each one of us personally, right here in our own heads, we have to change. And once we recognize that it's us, I have to change.
Right. That was something you said before we started the interview about, you know, that when you sit around saying, if only they would change.
Yes. Nothing will change.
We need to shift it to, I'm going to change.
As long as we keep saying that they must change, nothing will change. Because they are waiting for you to change.
Exactly.
But when I say, I will change.
Yeah.
Who was it? Was Buddha or Gandhi said, be the change you want to see, or whatever it was. But that is so true.
Yeah, right.
That's just not some airy-fairy quote. That really is true. And once you make the change in your own head, you start making those changes. You start becoming consciously aware of your thoughts, how they're directing your life, how they're impacting on your relationship with others. These angry thoughts, these presumptuous thoughts, these arrogant thoughts, they impact on people in a very real way, and they give that back to you. People often ask me, aren't you scared in your travels? And I say, no, it's attitude. Attitude is everything.
You know, children will do what they see, not what we say, right?
Absolutely.
You know? And so I had a situation a number of years ago, about a decade ago, before I came to the island, where I was very excited about the absolutely awesome benefits of eating a 100% raw diet.
Yes.
And I was talking about it. I tried it, and then I took a break because I was pregnant, and I wasn't quite sure how to do it. So I started reading more books and talking to people and trying to explore it. And then one of my girlfriends had been like, yeah, I get it that you're excited. But, you know, she wasn't really turned on by my enthusiasm. Mm. And so then my son was born, and I met a bunch of people who were doing raw food, and I had sort of a support group, and I'm like, yes, I knew enough then I could do it. So I just started eating 100% raw, and I did so for about a year, and it was fabulous. And during that time, I wasn't talking to my girlfriend about it. In fact, I didn't talk to anyone about it. It had become such a personal decision. It wasn't something that I wanted to go out and be flogging around, right? Mm-hmm. And my girlfriend, like halfway through that year, she was like, it was annoying when you were telling me about it, but now as I've been watching for 6 months while you're doing it, I'm really, really curious, and I want to learn more. Can you tell me some things about this? And so it was really interesting how I learned at that point, and at other points in my life, it became more solidified that the best thing I could do if I wanted to see a change was to just do it myself, if possible, be visible, but not in an obnoxious way, and allow people to just see what it's like. So I have a girlfriend who gave up her driver's license on the island a while ago and went a couple years without driving. And I was so inspired every time I'd see her walking down the road. And I thought, wow, her doing that is 1,000 times more inspirational to me than if I read a book talking about 9,000 reasons for why I shouldn't drive my car.
That's right. The thing is, what I discover, you can't change anybody. It is not in anybody's power to change somebody. They have to want to change themselves. They have to take it on board. All you can do is set an example, exactly what you did.
Right.
All you can do is set an example and say, this is what I'm doing, and this is what's happening to my life. Because I'm doing these things, here I am, I'm doing this, which is why I use my life as this example. Back in Cape Town, I was painting stuff, and I wasn't speaking to anybody, and I wasn't writing books. I'm marginally dyslexic. Writing books was not on my list of things to do. I certainly wasn't giving public talks. I wasn't doing that either. But it was an evolution of things, because I had to then sat down and I realized I have the technology that'll sort out my spelling, and if I type the letter A will always look like the letter A.
Right.
It doesn't matter how hard I hit that keyboard.
Right.
Whereas when I write the letter A, it looks like 1,000 different kinds of things. So I discovered that through technology, I'm able to actually express my thoughts in words and put together a book. And once I had this great big chunk of a book, I had to sell it. And that involved reading it and then in question and answer, speaking to people. Mm-hmm. And then this progressed into realizing that I actually had an ability to use my voice to impact people's minds. And I recognize this is incredibly powerful media. But in doing this, I recognize it's only when people absolutely want to change that they will change. And the only thing I can do is actually live this life of mine and say, there I was in Cape Town. I was just painting people's houses, working on building sites. Then I drove around the world and I somehow managed to write this book. And now here I am back in America and I'm speaking to the most incredibly intelligent, world-known scientists, etc., etc. And I have thought this life into existence.
Right.
By consciously being aware of how powerful my thoughts are, and everybody can do it. Everybody can do it.
Right. You know, whenever you have an expansion of society and then you're going to have a contraction. Right.
Yeah.
Expand and contract, whether it's more deer, more deer, more deer. And then they eat all the stuff there is to eat. And then they have starvation. You have less deer, less deer, less deer. And then you have more deer, more, you know, everything expands and contracts. Mm. And I think there's a lot of people during a contraction, because they've been told life is only good in an expansion stage.
Yes.
You know, when we're, expanding and we're, you know, the economy.
It's got to grow, it's got to grow.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a bull economy or it's a this, you know, all these things for like positive, negative.
Yeah.
I don't know if this bothers you, but like I'm from California.
Yeah.
And in California, where I came from, central, coastal, and southern, not a lot of rain.
No.
You know, and so I love
the rain.
Rain. And yes, up here, I definitely have rekindled my love of sun because I don't get much of it. But what I found amazing is people would say on the radio, you're listening on your way to school or whatever, oh, it's going to be a lovely day. No clouds, sunny, 85. And I'd go, what the hell makes that lovely?
Yes.
Why are you putting a judgment on that? Just tell me it's going to be sunny.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they go, oh, well, it's not going to be a very nice day. We've got clouds moving. And I'm like, what are you doing to your listeners? You're telling them they should be depressed and unhappy because there's some clouds coming in to drop some rain.
Yeah.
And they
grow
do that
their
up
crops
here. Yeah. And I'm like, when it rains,
it rains.
I am dancing with joy because I don't have to water my garden.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And so
this is something
the
that
mind
I
mind control, like you're saying, over and over.
Well, this is something that I got to in this book. I said, the weather is what the weather is.
Mm-hmm.
And I continue to live my life in conjunction, whatever the weather is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I'm going to be happy one day and sad the next day. And it's the weather, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I'm controlling.
Right.
And it's not something that, yes, of course, put on your raincoat and whatnot, but then walk out proudly into the rain with the sun going, oh, there's an author in Seattle, one of my favorite authors.
Thomas Eugene, Tom Robbins, American author, best-selling novels, serial comedies, wildly poetic. Even Cowgirls, Get the Blues, Breakfast of Champions, Made in Heaven. Those are movies. Still Life with Woodpecker, Jitterbug Perfume.
Yeah.
So what do you love about him?
Oh, he's great. He writes these deeply philosophical books. Tom Robbins, favorite author in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody should read him.
Got it.
He writes these deeply philosophical, highly hilarious books. I mean, this man is, he doesn't even have a box. He's just right out there in space somewhere.
Uh-huh.
But he writes this, he had this one hero, and I think it was in...
Yeah, Skinny Legs and All.
No, I think it was in...
B is for Beer.
Oh, yeah, I know. I read them all. I think it was in Still Life with a Woodpecker, it might have been. He has this hero, this man who is built like all heroes. He's tall and fierce and has got a stare and he's like, you know, he's the man in control. But
rawr.
he describes how this man walks in rain.
Oh.
Everybody else bends down and hunches their shoulders
right.
and sticks and looks to the ground. This man walks with his shoulders back, the rain pelting his face as he plows through the elements. And that's how you've got to approach weather. There it is. Whether it's weather you like or not.
Right.
There it is.
Deal with it. Move on.
Proudly. Yes.
Yeah.
No, if anybody hasn't read Tom Robbins, here's a serious punt for this author. He's right here in Seattle. You've got to read this man.
Well, apparently I probably need to call him. And
you need to call him.
Read some of his books and maybe have him interviewed.
Oh, yeah. No, this man is completely off the wall. Yeah.
Ooh, that would be fun.
Oh, yeah.
I like off the wall people.
Yeah.
So we're going to have you do a reading of something at the end that sort of corresponds. Well, okay, a couple things. At this point, I'm looking around thinking, I got to still talk about this and that.
Okay.
So you had mentioned ignoring the center ground.
The media does.
Right,
because it's
exactly.
not good news. It's not news, you know. Who cares? that everything's going well and life goes on and the crops are growing, yay high, and who cares?
Well, and, you know, sometimes it is all going well. So you're right. I mean, they don't talk about that. Do you know about Yes Magazine?
No.
Yeah, oh, goodness gracious. So Yes Magazine, it's a big, you know, YES with an exclamation point. Mm. And it's from Bainbridge Island is where they started it. So it's a local. A lot of stuff is created. Seattle's amazing. There's so much going on here.
I have been having a fabulous time in Seattle. Really. It's so much here. It's so vibrant. Yeah.
It is.
Excellent people I've met.
And so Yes Magazine does this really beautiful job of making this fabulous magazine that is focused 100% on basically all of these perspectives on the positive things that are happening that are not getting mainstream coverage. Because, of course, mainstream's all gloom and doom, right? Because if we're scared, we're easier to manipulate.
Exactly.
They talk about all sorts, you know, the tiny houses, you know, because you've got these people who are sitting around like, oh, well, it's an economic downturn and I can't afford to buy a 4,000-foot home somewhere and I can't get a new car and that means my life sucks because that's what Dick Cheney said when he said the American lifestyle is not negotiable, right? Like right there, earlier at the beginning of the interview, you were talking about our ability to change versus what we're spoon-fed is what we need. And the thought that tells us we can't change. And Dick Cheney, when he came out and said, you know, the American lifestyle is not negotiable about 12 years ago, 8 years ago, whatever. It was like, guess what, people? Don't you dare think outside the box. Don't you even think for a minute about not buying everything we want you to buy. You've got to stay the way you are because all those corporations need you to keep shopping like that.
Oh, yes. You are the absolute consumers. You are the top of the consumer chain are the Americans.
Right. We're the drivers in that engine. We're the fuel that keeps the engine going. Mm. And then the part about, you know, the center ground, that sort of ties in with the bell curve.
Yes, idea. Of course. Of course it does. But the thing is, the problem with the people in the middle, there is, of course, they're not the heroes. They are just the complacent mass. And the problem is that these people who live in the center ground really do need to start doing something, becoming mindful of the power of their thoughts. Start thinking forward. This book, Searching for Galileo, is multi-layered. It has the scientists that I speak to about their science, their thinking. Mm-hmm. Then I have my adventures in the car and driving around America solo. And then I have these mental jamming sessions in which I just invite anybody who feels like having an hour-long mental jamming session with me in which they come with their field of expertise and a what-if question. What if we change this within my field of expertise to create a better, more harmonious, more beneficial future for all species on the planet?
Right.
Let's do this. And I've found in these talks that I've been having that people find it very difficult to project to the future.
Right.
The conversations always edge back to the past and what did happen and what is happening. And I'm going, yes, but I don't want you to do that. I want you to project your mind to this harmonious, idealized, functional future. Make that your goal. See how your field of expertise would change in order to fit into that and then work backwards to where we are now so that we can change how we think today in order to work towards that goal in the future. And people find that very difficult to do. And it's because of the way we are taught in our schools to think backwards, back to this is the way it's always been. That's the way it's always happened. That's the way it's always going to be.
Right.
And you go, how did you go from that's the way it's always happened to that's the way it's always going to be?
Right.
And that is exactly the problem. We need to get out of that. It's not a box. It's a circle.
Or it's the people in the center are waiting to be told what to do.
Because they have, because of
they've
also
been trained in that way.
Yes, exactly. It is a mindset training.
You look at Albert Einstein and his quote where he says, I think, basically, imagination is far more valuable and powerful than education or knowledge. It's all about imagination.
Yes.
And it's true because there is no, the one constant in life is change.
Well, of course.
You know, and so if we're going to, we know things are going to change. And if we don't sit around and be mindful and pay attention to how they're going to change, then they're going to change possibly in very chaotic, weird, strange ways because we just didn't choose.
Well, it happens now, right now, while we're sitting here. Mm-hmm. It's also change is also known as evolution. And when I spoke
about epigenetics,
it
could you define that?
So they had the genome, and they thought they'd sort of cracked the whole genetic code, and everything was going to be understandable from then onwards. And then they discovered that it was a lot more complex than that. And then a thing called epigenetics is now a new field of study. Mm-hmm. And the chap that I spoke to in Pullman, this conversation I had with him made me see that evolution occurs right here, right now, every mm-hmm. minute, every second, every nanosecond. We are evolving, and not just we, but our environment is evolving, and it's evolving in reaction to our thoughts and actions. And in turn, we are evolving mm-hmm. in reaction to our actions and the things we create. Mm-hmm. So this evolution is a constant ebb and flow of action, reaction, and it's not either good or bad. We are not the most evolved species, thereby the best species on the planet. We have simply evolved very much in one direction, and other mm-hmm. species have decided to evolve in another direction. But what I believe is now that we're becoming aware of how powerful our thoughts are to drive this evolution, that our evolution up to now has been an unconscious thing, but we are now able, because of what we know about the mind, to positively, mindfully direct where we will evolve to. Mm-hmm. And that brings with it, to my horror, I discover huge responsibility for each of us mm-hmm. to understand that by our thoughts and actions today, we are laying the foundation of the species that we will become in the future. So it becomes increasingly urgent that we all become more mindful of what we're doing with water, with the things we decide to create, the things that we decide to build, the chemical processes we decide to bring into our homes, the poison underneath our kitchen cabinets. Mm-hmm. These are all things that are impacting on our epigenetic code, on our children, on our unborn children. And we really, really need to start thinking about that really, really deeply.
Yeah. Yeah, we do, especially with, I believe the new numbers are like 1 in 64 children born today has recognizable autism.
Yes, it's huge.
And, you know,
none of these scientists are making that leap. So this is also why I'm not quoting any names at this point.
Right.
Because I'm not, you know, what I'm saying now is really just my own opinion. This
but
is
environmental
no
factors affect us. And
but
our
absolutely.
Thoughts are also environmental factors.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is what's increasingly being shown. And they're working on new experiments to show this empirically and so on. And yes, so that storage of poison that you have in your house, either mm-hmm. in the garage or in the cupboard underneath your kitchen sink, all of that is switching epigenetic markers on and off in your epigenetic code, which become permanent. So mm-hmm. when you decide to spray an insect because you don't like him, as opposed to lifting him up and just putting him outside, you are doing something to your own self.
Yeah, and your children
and your children.
Dog that walks by.
And it's not just, oh, it's a poison thing, it'll go away. No, it doesn't. It actually sticks around. And this is a mm-hmm. shocking thing. It's a shocking thing to discover how very malleable, how very delicate this evolutionary thing is. We make these choices every second, and it's scary because it goes, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that responsible.
It is. It is. Yeah. And you have to then take a step back and go, okay,
yeah, I know.
I will understand that, and I will not freak out about
Yes. This is the thing. You know, I'm at that point is I'm understanding this, but am I freaking out? Yes, I am freaking out just a little bit because I'm thinking, I want to apologize to my child. I'm so sorry. I really am. I didn't know.
Right. Well, and the piece around mindfulness and stuff, it's like, you know, so often there's a thing going on. You'll see a sign over there on the corkboard. It says for me, and it has a picture of a little bee on it. Mm. So right now there's a big conversation on the island, as around the world, about neonicotinoids.
Yes.
Right. And so like the EU is removing some situations, and everyone's paying attention to it because it's clearly an issue. And it's just interesting because what came up on the island as I got a little bit involved was a realization mm-hmm. that had not hit me before, which is that I have no idea what to do with a chemical. Mm. I mean, like, my house has baking soda, you know, and vinegar and, you know, maybe
baking soda is brilliant stuff.
Oh, it's awesome.
Brilliant stuff.
But I go out and like, I've 10 years I've had a farm. I've sold at the market. I do all this stuff. I have no problems anywhere on my farm, and I don't use any chemicals of any sort. Mm. I have chickens and horses, so their poop is my own, you know, natural fertilizer. And so I was like, well, wait a minute. I wouldn't even know what to do with a bottle of Roundup or one of these things. And then we,
you don't want to touch it, first
right.
of all.
Right. Well, I knew that. But we were at a, there was a conversation where people were like, oh, it's not about let's get rid of this chemical and let's go to that chemical. It's more of a shift from why do we think we need the chemical and how can we rediscover that we actually don't need any chemicals? Mm. And, you know, what are we wanting? You know, why do we have a desire for a lawn that's just monocrop grass?
Can I speak to lawns?
Yes. Yeah.
You say, oh, lawns. Lawns. When I first came to America, the very, very first time I came to America. In fact, I talk about lawns in my book and just how huge a luxury this green lawn is. And that's how I thought about it. And I came to America and I landed in Los Angeles and, whoa, perfection in the lawn. I'm, wow, seriously, perfect lawn. And now I've spent this journey traveling along the East Coast, and these people are lawn obsessive.
Yeah.
You have this beautiful, green, lush lawn that gets mowed once a week. No grass blade shall be out of line ever. And so I'm driving along, and I'm thinking about this lawn, and it's dawning on me. These lawns are actually even on the curbs. Even when you're driving through the cornfields in Idaho, you've got these lawns along this perfect monoculture.
Right, of GMO corn.
Exactly what you just said. It occurs to me suddenly that this is a green desert. This lawn is of no value to anything other than maybe the odd earthworm, but then you're putting so many chemicals on this lawn that's probably completely stone dead under there.
Right.
So I have obsessively started photographing wildflowers where I can find them. I'm launching a campaign for anti-mowing. Strength to the wildflower. Wildflowers are important. Bees love wildflowers.
Yep.
You know, we don't
untended, unsprayed wildflowers.
And they're beautiful. You have got so many beautiful wildflowers. And when I do see a meadow, I saw a wonderful meadow, I must tell you. On the Lincoln Highway, there is a memorial to flight that crashed, 9/11. And it was a very touching memorial, I must say. It was all the normal marble slabs all around, but then there was this meadow, untended meadow, under which all the victims of that crash are still there because they couldn't work out how to remove them in a respectful way.
Right.
So underneath this beautiful meadow, and I was there in the springtime,
right,
fields and fields of wildflowers, is this memorial.
Right.
And I think to myself, this is so beautiful. Yeah. It is so much more beautiful than a green lawn.
Right.
And you know, so much less effort, so much less heartache. It's just a meadow.
It's just better.
It's better. And it was full of birds and insects. Yes, I'm mounting a campaign.
Right, anti-mowing.
Anti-mowing, yes. Bring back the meadows.
Right.
Yes, is my thing.
Yeah. Well, when people focus on lawns, there's such a loss. They don't focus on people. We were in Redmond when Roman was born, my eldest son, and we moved into this house. It was a corner lot. All the houses were basically the same. My husband, who I wasn't married to yet, had flown me up to pick out a house. So I'm going to buy one of these houses, and I don't care which one. You pick out the one that you like, right? And so they're all the same. So I picked the one with the biggest lot. And all of the neighbors, when they came over to say hi, like once, right? Oh, Joe was the guy who had been the husband of the couple that had lived there before us. He was such a great guy. He spent 20 hours a week on his lawn. Everyone loved Joe because he had the best lawn in the neighborhood. I kid you not. That was
we
all they could tell me about
We define our neighbors
Joe.
By their lawn.
That
That's
was
so
it.
Sad.
It was Stepford Wives all over. And then, of course, I'm not a lawn person.
No.
So the next thing you know, people are like coming over literally and saying, you know, would you like us to mow your lawn for you? And I'm looking at them like,
no?
You don't know my name. You haven't asked me about my newborn child, and you're worried about my lawn.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, that's all. It was very interesting.
Yeah. You know, everything, this is something that it's a green desert, really.
Yeah.
It impacts in so many different ways. I'm not a great gardener myself. I have a little quote in the beginning of the book.
Oh, good. Pull it out, and then you've got that one at the end.
Yeah.
Right, because I'm always asked, all of my authors have to answer the question of what message of hope do you have to give to the people of today, and in particular the youth, because they are really pretty overwhelmed by what we have left them on this planet. And I think that quote at the end you were going to read is really beautiful to that.
I don't really consider myself that profound that I have these answers, but I want to just... So I have this quote in the book in the very beginning when I'm doing my little background thing. It's here about gardening. I really don't like gardening. It's like setting up a private war zone with nature.
Oh.
So gardening is not my thing. So I fight for meadows.
You should come to my farm the next time you're in the area, because it's a great non-fight. It's a fabulous, natural, collaborative effort between me and all these living creatures. It's beautiful.
Yes, that's the point.
Yeah.
It is a collaboration.
Yeah.
It is not a victory.
No.
It's not a victory over nature. We don't want to be victors over nature. We want to be friends, harmonious compatriots.
We are co-creating a food forest for all the living creatures. When the birds come and eat my berries, I don't buy netting and chase them away. Yeah. I go, okay, enjoy the berries, you know?
There's probably more than I can eat anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so.
So what I learned from this entire journey, in a nutshell, I spent the entire year almost completely alone. I spent days and days and days of not speaking, in complete silence, not speaking to anyone, not hearing any radio. I finally just turned off. I had my iPad along, but I finally just turned that off because I just couldn't bear the vocals and the thoughts contained in these vacuous pop songs. So I spent hours and hours and days in complete silence. And so at the end of my book, I conclude the things that I learn, and one of them is this. Silence and the condition of being alone are considered anathema in today's world of multimedia and constant connection. But great thoughts, ideas, and originality do not spring from the noisy mass. It is important to embrace our silence and solitude, to hold them dear, as it is only in them that we will discover the true depths of our thoughts and the wellspring of our joy. And only in the silence can we start to create the changes that will make us fearless, happier, and more content in our lives. We all want to change the world for the better. But often we stand on our soapboxes and say it is they who must change. The truth is we cannot change them or the world. The only thing we can change is ourselves, and that is hard. For many, change is an uncomfortable thing. Most people love the idea of change, the delightful daydream of living a different life. But very few choose to go through the discomfort and inner turmoil that true change requires. But it is only when we are prepared to take this uncomfortable step that we can hope to bring the progressive change to improve not the world, but ourselves. For the world will continue turning, but we are destroying ourselves. There we go. Yeah. Profound thought of the day.
I know. Well, I love the piece about all that silence, because I worry about my children. Anytime there's not something to do, they turn to their little device and they turn something on. And for me as a child, if there's nothing to do, I
just
went
did
for
nothing.
A walk or I rode my bike.
Or you just sat there and you contemplated your navel. You just did nothing.
Exactly. And there's so much value in getting to know yourself in that way.
Yeah.
And
Just yes, good.
So, real quick, I want to make sure that people know how to. This is so cool. So, Annette was showing me her website earlier. You can find it at www.a for Annette, and then Yanl is how you pronounce it, right? But it's JAHNEL.com. And I will have this on my website as well. So, you will be able to find it if you come to voiceofvashon.org/prose, poetry, and purpose. So come find me and you can get it there too. Her website is very entertaining and interactive. It helps you to follow in Annette's footsteps. It includes an album of photos for each of the countries that she traveled through. And because the book is organized according to bed rather than chapter, so bed number one, bed number two, all the beds that she slept in throughout this year, you can actually do something where you interact with Google Earth and you can click in, where was she for bed number 23? And it will take you directly to where she was, and you can see photos from that situation and that moment in her adventure. Let's see. You can also view her upcoming speaking schedule. You're headed down towards LA and then back across the country, correct?
Yeah, from here I go down all the way to San Diego, and then I head east again towards Phoenix, Austin, Atlanta, and then back to Richmond. And
Okay.
So, and that schedule is on the website under the contact.
Right. And yeah, and so she's got an email. Mm. You can contact her via email and check out more about the book. Mm. also, so at the end of this, you had this fabulous fan that all of these people had written all of their wishes and thoughts on, and then that ended up living with your friend in Germany,
I believe. That's right. She's
and
using
still drives around.
Yes, she still does.
Awesome.
Yes.
And what was the like thought of the van at the end? It was the
One Planet, One People.
Right, and then it was a piece of art.
Oh, a global artwork, yes, of goodwill, yes, 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 yes.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This has been fabulous.
Yes, it's been
all right,
great
everyone,
fun.
Have
Good
a
chat.
Great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. In the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the secret that hides inside, that hides inside. Oh, oh, oh. Let it be seen.